afternoon. I'd like to welcome everyone to the Second Court of Appeals. We have two cases on oral argument this afternoon at 1:30. We have another one for oral argument at 3 o'clock, and another case set for submission without oral argument. I understand everyone has checked in. Before we begin, I want to introduce the panel to you. To my right is Justice Lee Gabriel. To my left is Justice Mark Pittman, and I'm Justice Bonnie Sutterth. If everyone's ready, I'll have the clerk call the first case.
The court will now call Audrey Diane Gurley versus Craig Neil Gurley. May it please the court, Mr. Brian Ballou will argue for the appellant. Mr. Earl Waddell will argue for the appellate.
You may proceed.
May it please the court. There are 6 points of error that are presented in appellant's brief. Briefly, those points are the trial court erred in a number of ways. First, in ruling that the 1998 decree that's at issue here was void. Secondly, that it wasn't a valid agreement per Rule 11 of Texas Rules of Civil Procedure. In finding that the 1998 decree was void as a judgment nunc pro tunc outside the plenary power of the court to enter such an order. Trial court also erred in ruling that the 1998 decree was not a contract between the parties, and erred again in substantively altering the division of the property as contained in the 1998 decree. Finally, the trial court erred in denying Ms. Gurley's motions for summary judgment, which contained these same points that were heard and denied the day of trial. And I'd like to clarify that, because I know I will do it, I will refer to Ms. Gurley as Ms. Dillman probably throughout my presentation. She has since remarried from the divorce, and I've only known her as Ms. Dillman. So if I make that mistake, I apologize, and that's the reason why. To summarize, where appellant's case rests is that the petition for declaratory judgment that was filed by Mr. Gurley is a collateral attack on the judgment, considering that it was filed at least 15 years after the final divorce decree or the 1998 decree was entered, and well after the time for the direct attacks through the appeals process had expired. Our position is that these were impermissible collateral attacks for a number of reasons. And I'm going to turn first to the ruling on the nunc pro tunc, since that is the cause of action that was pled by Mr. Gurley in his petition for declaratory judgment. As I'm sure the court is aware, a nunc pro tunc is proper to correct a clerical error that's made on a judgment in the entry, such as a typographical or a scrivener's error. And in this case, there was a proper nunc pro tunc entered approximately 2 years before the 1998 decree was entered, to correct an amount that was mistakenly typed in on a judgment that was awarded to one of the parties. An improper nunc pro tunc corrects a judicial error that was made in the entry of the nunc pro tunc order. There was no judicial error that was made here. In order for there to be a judicial error, there has to be the exercise of the judicial function by the judge entering the order. And the case law as cited in my brief indicates or supports that this requires the judge to review the facts, apply the law to the facts, and make a decision and pronounce that judgment based on that consideration.
Is the changing of the award of the retirement benefits not a judicial decision? That's not a clerical error. To say 15 years later, when it becomes of import because he's just retired, all of a sudden she gets 15 more years worth of retirement than she got in the first and second judgment. How is that just a clerical error?
Your Honor, it is not just a clerical error, and our argument is not that it is a clerical error. Our argument is that what actually happened, although it was a nunc pro tunc that was filed, a motion for nunc pro tunc that was filed, what occurred was actually that under Rule 11 was entered rather than a nunc pro tunc. This was an agreement of the parties that was entered.
But a Rule 11 agreement is only good in a pending case, and this case was not pending. You filed a motion for nunc pro tunc, but it was not a pending case at the time that Mr. Gurley signed this agreed decree.
Respectfully, Your Honor, I would disagree based on the concept of any suit pending has been construed liberally by both the Amarillo Court of Appeals and the Court of Appeals here in Cole and in Cunningham. Because in Cole, there was dealing with a property division. The parties filed an enforcement, and during the pendency of the enforcement, this is several years after the original order was entered, after the enforcement was filed, the parties came together with an agreement that it entered under Rule 11.
It was a pending enforcement.
Yes, ma'am.
And we didn't have that in this case.
And we're asking the court here, by analogy, that the nunc-pro-tunc, the filing of the nunc-pro-tunc as the filing of the enforcement, enabled the court to act in this matter, and this is indeed a pending matter based on the filing of the nunc-pro-tunc, much in the same context as an enforcement would open the matter back up for consideration by the court. The nunc-pro-tunc did the same thing.
An enforcement asks the court to exercise judicial determinations, judicial discretion. A motion for judgment nunc-pro-tunc does not ask the court to exercise any kind of discretion or determination. It says, please correct this Scribner's error.
Yes, ma'am. I agree that there is that distinction there, but we still argue that it still opens the matter as pending because it is still before the court to take some sort of action at that point. And because of that, the matter is pending at the time that the Rule 11 was entered in this case. In essence, it is
Rule
not.
Rule 11 was actually signed by the parties before the motion for judgment nunc-pro-tunc was filed, was it not?
Yes, ma'am, it was. And I would argue that there isn't.
And didn't the motion itself, which embodies the agreement, say this is really just to clean up some things that the military requires to be in the order? That was the purpose of it.
Yes, ma'am. The filing of the nunc-pro-tunc was to correct language that
can't remember if it was the Air Force or the Army, but
it was the Department of Finance Accounting or the Defense Finance and Accounting Services that covered.
They required this language.
Yes, ma'am.
That was the purpose of it. And there was nothing in that motion that said, and also we're going to change the terms of it too while we're at it.
No, there wasn't. There was not.
It looks like if there was a meeting of minds that would give rise to a contract or a Rule 11 agreement, the meeting of the minds was, we need to get this order in compliance with what the Department of Finance requires in order to calculate this when the time comes.
In the pleadings that were filed by Mr. Gurley, I believe that is the representation that was made. I was not the attorney on the case at the time, so I don't have any direct knowledge.
But both sides signed it, right? It was an agreed.
Yes, ma'am. Both sides signed it under agree to as to form and to substance. It contained language that said it was an agreement of the parties and construed as a contract and binding as the same. And the changes in the language between the second decree and the third decree were not only to get to your point, not only to the actual language on how DFAS would pay out to Ms. Gurley, Ms. Dillman now, the changes that were made by Mr. Gurley's attorney, because Ms. Gurley was pro se at the time, made more specific the language on how she would be paid her award, but also made a change to the award language itself, which are in two different sections. It's hard to understand how changing one section, because these belong in two different sections in a divorce decree, there's the award, pardon me, to husband and award to wife, and then post that section is the detailed language that's required by DFAS as far as the payment for that they required in order to effectuate the actual award. And these changes were made by Mr. Gurley's attorney. And so,
who admits he messed up?
He does. And we argue as well that because of the status of the rule, because we argue this is a Rule 11, that his testimony post that Rule 11 is immaterial because the Rule 11 becomes an agreed judgment, which is construed as a contract. And unless there is any...
No evidence of a meeting of the minds, is there?
There is some evidence of that, yes.
So you mean to tell me when the second divorce decree was decided, we have evidence here before us that there's no issue of material fact, that both parties intended that this gentleman, who retired 20 years after the original divorce decree was entered, that he would turn over half of his entire retirement? You're telling me that that's what the agreement beyond There's no material fact issue that that was the agreement of the parties at that time?
That is not what I'm trying to say, Your Honor. I'm trying to say...
Isn't there, at the end of the day, isn't there still a question as to whether there was a meeting of the minds?
I don't think so, Your Honor. And the reason being that when an agreed decree gets put in place, it becomes a contract, and it is interpreted as a contract, but is not subject to contract defenses, which meeting of the minds would be one. And it operates that way to cut off any future instances like we have now where one party comes back and says, well, we didn't. I don't agree to that. I didn't agree to it then. I certainly don't agree to it now, as opposed to what's in the four corners of the document, which is unambiguous, and it's not subject to multiple interpretations because the award language is very clear. And to prevent folks from going outside of the four corners of that document so that it can be applied as it was written to, because given the fact situation that, you know, that exists here and hypothetically, it is understandable that someone could agree to do that and then change their mind. Because at this time, if we look in the third decree, in the second decree, it says...
Hypothetically, I want to know what's before me.
Yes, sir, Your Honor. And I will say this, that in the decree, it contains language that Mr. Gurley was retired at the time that the 1998 decree was entered. And he wasn't. And I think that is an indication that that would be motivation for him to agree to a division of 50% at that time, because if he was retired or planning on retiring shortly thereafter, there are not the following 15 years of his retirement that he gets. But I believe there's another independent grounds for the validity of this order, because it does contain all of the jurisdictional recitals that the order needs to, on its face, show the court had the authority to enter the order as it's written. And there's a long history of case law that says that absent positive evidence from the record showing the court did not have the jurisdiction to enter this or some authority to act, that or lack jurisdiction, pardon me, that those jurisdictional recitals are granted or given absolute verity.
So if that's in an order that's presented to a court as a motion to enter a judgment non pro tunc, you can just go change anything and everything you want because those recitals are in that order?
The short answer, Your Honor, is yes. And I believe so because it's
your best case that says that, not just that you give verity to the recitals, but that says that you can change the substance, the complete substance of a previous judgment just because that language is in there.
Your Honor, I believe it goes back to the Rule 11, because this is a difference between the judge making a decision to do this, because the judge is absolutely not allowed to go back and substantively change the property division.
So by non-pro-tunc, you can confer jurisdiction on a court that otherwise would not have jurisdiction as to the merits of the case by agreement. You can agree that the court has jurisdiction when the court, in fact, doesn't have jurisdiction. Is that what you're saying?
Not exactly, Your Honor.
But the court doesn't have jurisdiction. Court has lost plenary power.
I mean, this isn't going back and changing the names of the parties.
No, it is not. And it is an odd situation. But there is case law that if I have cited in my brief, I don't have the case name off the top of my head, that says even if this order would be void, and for the sake of argument, I'll say this order would be void because the court lacks jurisdiction, that without the positive showing from the record that there is no jurisdiction for the court to enter this order, that the jurisdictional recitals that are in the order control. And and I will get the case law and I will have it on rebuttal. I will give you the case name on that. And it's a very old case, I admit. But I believe it's still good law. And this is, you know, to kind of sum up, because my time is running short.
Was the jurisdiction in the case that you're citing some other kind of jurisdiction, like in personam jurisdiction or some kind of, other than the jurisdiction to act after a final judgment? We're talking about two different kinds of jurisdiction.
We're talking, I believe in the case that I'm citing, it is jurisdiction over the parties. And
over the parties,
over
not
the parties.
Over the lawsuit.
Yes, and the case law that I found, Alfonso v. Skadden, is a different one. When it talks about what's in the record that can show that positively the court doesn't have jurisdiction are things such as testimony and affidavits that the court didn't have jurisdiction because the child didn't live in Texas, for example, or defects in the pleading or failure of service and things like that. Not just that because of the way the law is constructed, the court
would... the case where the court had lost jurisdiction and somehow it was revived by recitals?
I do not believe so, Your Honor. I do not have that...
And you understand that's a very different thing.
Yes, I do, Your Honor. And I do not have an answer for you on that.
So there's no case out on that that you know of?
Not that I'm aware of, but I'd be happy to supplement with authority if the court would like that. And I don't know how much longer I have, but... These issues were also approached in our motions for summary judgments, which were denied. The court allowed the collateral attack on the property division by substantively altering what was in the 1998 decree. And as I said before, but I'd like to reiterate, that this is the court's exercise of ministerial function over the courts. My time has expired.
Thank you. Thank you.
May it please the court, co-counsel. Bob and I were contacted by the general about 2 years ago when he was anticipating his retirement on July the 1st of 2015. And having talked to at that time he was in the Pentagon in Washington running the entire Air Force Reserve. But there was some correspondence between him and the Air Force about how they were going to divide the benefits, and I think they told him they were going to give 50% to his wife and 50% to him, and that's what sparked this controversy. He had no idea for almost 20 years that something had happened from their first 1996 decree that would give her more than what a major would have had in 1996 with a number of years service. He's also an Academy graduate, so basically he just never thought about it for the next 15 or 16 years. Now let me say this. And if you look at the record, you'll see that from what I remember from torts in law school, there's one way to defend a dog bite case, or there's three ways to defend a dog bite case. One, I don't have a dog. Two, the dog didn't bite you. And what if he bit you, didn't hurt you? And that's basically what the appellant's argument's been through this whole case. For example, this last one, he said, if the order is void, we still have a Rule 11 agreement that can be enforced as a contract. You see, in other words, I don't have a dog and it didn't bite you, but well, hold it a minute, it didn't hurt you. So let me speak to the summary judgment issue quickly. First off, if you look at Dan Lawson versus that I cited, summary judgment is not appropriate when there's an issue of intention. And in this case, it's certainly full of intention. Like you ask, was there any consideration for this supposed Rule 11 agreement? Well, if there is, that's an issue of intention. So the fact that the judge denied both of our summary judgment motions, I think, was correct. We made those summary judgment motions to be sure we'd covered up everything before we had the trial. The judge held the summary judgment issues till the trial, and he decided them right before trial, and then we went to trial. So we've attached the judge's letter as an exhibit to our case, but basically, when we looked at this case at first, Bob and I both thought that this is a void order. It's void because it changes the substantial division of the property. The third the second non-proton just is not within the power of the court to grant. And so we started off with, well, maybe the judge will hold it that it might be a valid order, and then we'd need to clarify it. So if you look at our declaratory judgment, we've said it's void, and then we've said, but if you don't think it's void, judge, please clarify it. I agree with the judge in this case. He sees it exactly right. I mean, and this is the way that we initially looked at it, and that is the court had lost its plenary power, and trying to make this change by judgment not pro tunc is not proper. So basically the order is void. It's not void because it is void because it changed a substantial division of the community property also, but it's void on the very face of what it tried to do. It's just void because the court can't do that. And then it's void for another reason, as you can see in the family code. You can't change the substantial division of the community property in a post-judgment order anyway. You can't do it. And so So basically, it's void for two reasons, but I think it's mainly void, for the judge says that I've lost my plenary power, and the court couldn't have signed it. And we know Judge Carper signed this thing 16 years ago or so, but, and again, if you look at what had gone on, we know for one thing, as you asked, that the supposed Rule 11 agreement was signed before the motion non-proton was filed. Now, we have a new case that we didn't file here, but it's, let me give this to the court. It's Exito Electronics versus Trejo, but it's 142 Southwest 3rd, 302, Texas, 2004, and it's talking about a summary, it's talking about a Rule 11 agreement. And the real central case, and as you saw it, as the three of you have seen it so far, what it says, a Rule 11 agreement between the parties is and of itself is not a plea, pleading, or motion. So the fact that they signed a Rule 11 agreement supposedly in Mr. Smith's office, which nobody testified that she was ever there except her, and we know that the judge is the only ultimate decider of the credibility of the witnesses, and so three witnesses say she never came to this meeting, and she says she does, but we do know that they both signed the order before Mr. Smith brought it to Judge Carper. But he brought it on the same day. If you look at the times of the filing times on the documents, you'll see that the motion not pro tunc was brought to Fort Worth by Mr. Smith, filed, and then he went immediately upstairs and gave the judge the motion, and so the judge signed the order, granted the motion, and then he signed this supposed Rule 11 agreement, which is a final decree, right after that. Right. So the decree was signed whenever it was signed by both parties. I do think that the motion itself was only signed by the appellant. All right, I don't think that Mr. Smith had his client agree to the motion non pro tunc, but the appellant did because she was pro se. So there was no case motion pending, but you can't have a Rule 11 agreement unless something's pending, and to say that it's pending as soon as you sign, you know, in other words, the document that you sign makes it pending. You see what I'm saying? It bootstraps itself in. Oh, we needed a motion pending. Well, we don't have one, but now we signed a Rule 11, and there must have been a motion pending. Certainly, there was nothing pending from 1998 till 2015, not one thing pending until we filed our motion for declaratory judgment. We didn't file a motion in force because we thought that we wanted the judge to look at the underlying order, not try to enforce it, but look at it. So we've got a situation now where, and if you'll notice, going back to this, I don't have a dog. If I did have one, it didn't bite you and it didn't hurt you. When we had the hearing to sign the order, in the order we put a finding by the court that this was not a contract, all right? We didn't want to come back to you 2 years from now to find out whether it was a contract or not. And so the judge puts in the order, it's not a contract. Now, if you'll notice, they filed their counter petition and then they inserted this claim that this Rule 11 agreement, even if it's not a Rule 11 agreement, it's still a contract. You see? If the dog bit you, it didn't hurt you. Well, the Rule 11 agreement, it's no good, but, well, it's a contract. So we put into our answer, we filed another sworn denial to their claim, and we asked the judge at the end to say it's not a contract. And again, as the judge states in his letter, there's no consideration for this contract. If this is a contract, and see, here's the argument. Now, because they signed it in 1998, you can't even argue whether there was any contract or not. You can't even argue whether there was any consideration because it speaks for itself. It's like we win no matter what. That piece of paper sitting right there of 1998, we win, end of story. It's ridiculous. And as an aside, the money involved here is about $1 million because he retired as a major general. He gets about $9,000 a month military benefits, and he's a man of about 63. If he lives to be 83, if the wife gets half, she gets $1 million. So that's why we're litigating this, not because we just want to prove a point. We're litigating it because the Air Force right now won't divide the funds under the 1996 decree. And it's clear, if there's one contract, there's three contracts here. There's the first divorce decree that was correctly corrected to change the recitation about the family residence. The second the decree signed in December, a few weeks after, that one also has contract language in it that says, basically, you get half of it, my retirement for the wife, half of my retirement up to the point that we divorced in 1996. And that's what we commonly do. That's the way all retirement counts are done in divorce cases when people divorce. They don't give away future benefits. And so then we have a 1998 decree that has the same contractual relations in it that they want to enforce now. In other words, the two previous ones that say it's half and half at the date of divorce, now the third one says, no, it's half and half because we made an agreement 2 years later that I get half. Which one of those three contracts is enforceable? And what we did with in testimony to the judge, we had Mr. Gordy testify that he made no agreement with this ex-wife to give her half of his retirement funds. And that's what the judge says in his rendition letter. There's no meeting of the minds. There's no evidence at all that they ever agreed for her to have $1 billion worth of extra, because even when this 98 decree was signed, he was still in the reserves here in Fort Worth and still a major. He did reach the rank of Major General in Texas, and he commanded all the Texas reserves, and then the Air Force asked him to come back to Washington and run the whole reserves for the next 5 or 6 years. So that's why he retired off active duty, and we put that into the record too. But again, we attempted, and I think we've done it with this, it's clear from the judge's rendition letter that he understood exactly what's going on. And in fact, he makes the statement that Mrs. Gordy woke up one morning and said she had a windfall. And that's what we're still litigating. Does she get this windfall? But if this kind of 1998 decree stands, it means that you can come in and change the substantive court order substantially by a non-pro-tunk, and that's never been the law of Texas. And it can't be the law of Texas, because for one reason, stuff like this happening. But you can't reopen a case and readjust everything by a non-pro-tunk. You can't do it by clarification order either. Although I think in this case, the judge might have been able to clarify the third degree to take out all these substantive changes and tell the Air Force, this is what I mean. You see, that's why we put in the request for a clarification. If you did something like that, but of course then we'd be arguing up here that third order, as they did here, see, it's very strange. They argued that the court's judgment changed the substantive division of the property. It did. In their vision, they had a half and half order for all of his retirement, and he voided it. That changed the substantive division, so he can't do it. You see? We argue that you can't change the substantive division and your order is no good. And he argues, oh, you have changed the substantive division and your order is no good. One of us is right. And the main thing is, we're arguing about the 1998 order. It changed the substantive division. You can read clearly. Now, I would admit from Mr. Vick's testimony, he said he put the Air Force's language in it that was sent to him, and he copied it into it. It's not something he made up on his own, so it can't be. You might say he made a mistake. What he did is put in what the Air Force said. And then 16 years later, the people on the other side say, well, what you did really is give me half of what I didn't get when the first decree had in there. And so, I don't guess it's been frustrating, but trying to anticipate how to get this case over with one time, and I think we've got everything we need in this judge's order to get it over with. Again, if you'll see, it's, and one of the point of errors, we kind of stated in our reply brief that we didn't quite understand it, and I hope we've responded to everything, but because it's confusing when we heard that the judge's order of this year changed the substantive property division, meaning, oh, 1988 is good, and because you voided it, you see, you've changed the property division, which in my mind is a spurious argument. So we ask that you follow the judge's rulings, and again, the real issue is exactly the one that's in the first paragraph when he explains it, and that is the court had no plenary power to do what it was requested to do by what looked like an agreed motion non pro tunc. You see? It couldn't do it. It changed. If it didn't change the division, what did it do? Everybody left the divorce court thinking that she got half of his divorce, I mean, his pension on the date of divorce, and then 16 years later, she said, no, I get it all. If that's not a change to the substantive division by the 1988 order, I don't know what is a substantive change. And we agree with the judge that he had no power, the 324th District Court had no power to sign that third order, and therefore it's void. It's not voidable, it's just void, ab initio. And that's what we argued. And if it's void ab initio, I think he's exactly correct, and we hope that you'll uphold this judge's ruling.
Thank you, Your Honor. I'd like to start off by going to the discussion of the Rule 11 and the timing of the signing. This is something I was that I tried to get to in my initial argument. There is no due order or necessity inside Rule 11 that the agreement be reached after a case is filed and is pending. It just says that the way that the rule is constructed is that touching any suit pending, it is entered, signed, and in writing. And there's no specific timing requirement that agreement actually be rendered or be reached prior to the case actually being put on file and being pending at that point. And I think that's probably a good idea because there are cases, especially in family law, where people come and they have an agreement that they've made and we draft it and we then file an order, whether it's for child support or for a modification, we file a petition with an order in hand, which is essentially what they did here. And if we invalidate all of those types of agreements just because of this timing issue, then I think we undermine one of the substantially a purpose of the Rule 11. But I'd like to go on to talk about the lack of an agreement here versus what the court has done. Mr. Gurley's attorney has talked specifically about what you can't do and what the court can't do. And when my time ran out previously, I was trying to discuss the difference between the statutory authority and the case law authority for a court to enter a judgment is significantly different than the rights or the abilities of parties to reach an agreement regarding the property of their kids. And what we're talking about here isn't that the court, they took this order to the court, they took the motion to the court, and the judge exercised that judicial function that we were talking about earlier. Instead, what happened here is the parties did reach an agreement, and then they entered that agreement, and they're allowed to under Rule 11 to do that. And I think that this was properly entered because the filing, as we discussed earlier, the motion for nunc pro tunc, gave them authority to do it, or gave the authority of the court to sign the order to enter it. And at trial, it's important to remember, since this was brought up, that at trial Mr. Gurley testified that he reviewed the order that was drafted by his attorney. He had an opportunity to ask his attorney questions about that. And after that, he signed it under agreed to as to form and to substance and authorized his attorney to take it down and enter it with the court. This is not something that was done to Mr. Gurley. This is something that Mr. Gurley did in conjunction with his
then. He said he read it. He didn't say that he understood it to mean what you're now contending it means.
And I don't know, have any grounds to disagree with you on that, Your Honor, but I would ask the court to consider the fact that he did read it. And he did notice that there was a change to the language that was substantial in the division of the language. He had the opportunity to ask. So not if he didn't understood, as an intelligent man as he must be to hold the position that he does, he would have asked.
Let me ask you this.
Yes, ma'am.
I understand that the court is bound by the law.
Yes, ma'am.
But tell me how taking your position in this is a just result.
It is a just result because this was an agreement between the parties, Your Honor. It really comes
You're out. Really telling us that there was a meeting of the minds here with a straight face?
Yes, ma'am. Yes, sir, Your Honor. The parties agreed, they signed, they reviewed, and they entered this order. And because of this, I'll wrap up briefly for these and the reasons that I've cited in my brief. We're asking the court to reverse and render in favor of Ms. Gurley, now Dillman, in this case. If you have any other questions, I have a little bit of time left. Is there anything else?
No, thank you.
Thank you very much for your time.
Gentlemen, your case has been submitted.